Hey everybody, welcome to the Vet Tech Cafe. The Vet Tech Cafe is a podcast centered around veterinary technicians and nurses, hosted by myself, Dave Cowan, and my good friend Jeff Backus. We strive to discuss current issues facing our profession and give our colleagues a voice and a medium to enter into these discussions. Our guests are experts in the field that we hope can help our listeners work towards dealing with these issues, as well as coming up with solutions that can lead to change. One thing we would ask of you, our listeners, is to rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you're using. We're not exactly sure how or why this helps us, but apparently it does. If you have questions, comments, or would like to be a guest on the Vet Tech Cafe, please contact us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. So without further ado, come on in, grab yourself a cup of coffee, and get ready for another episode of the Vet Tech Cafe.
Hello, Vet Tech Caffeinators. Thank you very much for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe today. Dave, how's it going down there?
It's going well down here. It is, we're in the middle of fall, but it's actually kind of warm now. We had that storm that you guys are getting now. I think that's the Hurricane Delta that's coming through.
Yeah.
It rained here for like 2.5 days, and now you're getting that too up there, right?
It's been raining all day since before I got up. It's been wonderful because we need the water up here, but
not so great when you have a farm.
Yeah, no kidding. No,
there's just mud everywhere now.
I bet. So as this episode airs, Vet Tech Week just completed, National Vet Tech Week.
Happy Vet Tech Week, everybody.
Happy. I mean, I know, of course, we didn't really have an episode release for Vet Tech Week, but I want to say happy Vet Tech Week.
Well, we had the collaboration episode.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I guess we did have that. So I hope everybody had a really good week. Hope you guys felt well taken care of by your practices. You got some good swag, or maybe had some good raffles or some good meals.
We should do a social media post asking what everyone got.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking that myself. So yeah,
we'll do that this week.
Yeah, for sure. So anyway, I hope everybody had a good week. I know our profession really, really, really looks forward to that every year. And something kind of new for us. We're working with VetBloom to help get some CE opportunities for our listeners.
Yep.
They're going to be offering basically three kind of prescribed 1-hour classes that are going to be free for our listeners with a code. And, you know, by now it will have been announced that our website has launched. So anybody listening, you can go to our website and find information on that as well, or we'll post it on social media as well. But that'll be through VetBloom. We're pretty excited about that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, as we have a, I'm moving back to California. We have a California resident on our show today. I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about real briefly the RVT fee increases in California.
Crazy.
And the people, you know, or the letters we're asking everybody to write, we still have till November 9th on our website in the Cork board. There's a press release that has some sample letters, you know,
there's a link to the sample letters.
Yeah, so exactly. Just click all the, all the information is there. Feel free to change it up. Definitely let the California Veterinary Medical Board know how strongly you feel about these crazy fees just to be licensed. I mean, for a new technician student, between exams and licensing and applications and stuff, it's over $1,000 now to become an RVT.
And student debt. Don't forget student debt.
Right. Yeah. I didn't even really, I mean, I was just talking licensing, but yeah, the education component as well. So yeah. So anyway, we'll be talking about that quite a bit over the next month, because again, those have to be in by November 9th. But yeah, please help us out. Last time we talked about this, when they were doing the emergency fee increase, the number of letters they got were far more than they had ever gotten for any sort of thing to do with anything like this. So, and I know that that our listeners had a part of that. So please, if you wrote one last time, just change the name, because it's addressed to a different person this time. Feel free to just send that, but please help us out and have our collective voices of veterinary technicians be heard, which is kind of in line with what we're talking about tonight, Dave.
Yeah, it's going to be this is going to be a good episode.
Yeah. So, so I'd say we'll jump right in. So, those of you listening, our last episode, we had Brandy Halua on here on the Vet Tech Cafe as we kind of wrapped year one of our podcast. So we're going to kick off year two with the other half of the infamous Biz Combo, who also was our first guest a year ago. But we're going to talk about something completely different tonight that I'm super excited about. So just in case anybody either didn't hear the first episode with Liz or isn't familiar with her, I'll read a little bit of her bio. She's been practicing as a veterinary technician in California since 2006. In 2012, she was certified as a veterinary technician specialist in both small animal internal medicine and emergency and critical care. In addition to her work as consultant, trainer, relief tech, she also provides cannabis harm reduction education for veterinary practices and pet owners. years. She's co-editing a veterinary cannabis textbook. She's currently the chair of the AIMVT, the Academy for Internal Medicine Veterinary Technicians Credentialing Committee. She's really involved with the Not One More Vet support staff group, and then is very, very involved in the National Veterinary Professionals Union, which is what we're going to spend the bulk of our time talking to tonight. So without further ado, Liz, thank you so much for coming back by the Vet Tech Cafe. What can we get you for coffee tonight?
Oh, I'm definitely ordering a pumpkin spice goat milk latte tonight, please. Yes. And I would like the goat milk to be fresh from Dave's goats.
From Lone Cedar Farm in North Carolina.
Yes. Oh, boy. For sure.
I don't know that I can get that for
Dave,
you.
Dave, can you run out back and whip that up?
Yeah. you guys and your pumpkin spice.
I am happy to make this an annual occurrence.
Wonderful.
I'll just put that out there.
Well, I mean, you know, kind of just reading the little bit that we have here of your bio, I mean, we could talk about something completely different every time. So that would be fantastic. I feel like we don't have to really go through your history as a technician this time around. So Dave, why don't you just jump off with the first question?
Well, if you're concerned about how Liz got to where she's gotten and how she has so many tasks on her bio. Like I was reading through this again and I was like, oh my God, this is a full-time job just reading through all this.
No joke.
I don't, how do you have time?
Do you have an assistant?
Yeah.
Because you need one.
No, I don't have an assistant. I mean, you know, part of the beauty and the curse of working as a relief technician, right, is you get to set your own schedule and your own hours. And so what that has afforded me is the ability to pick and choose the things that I do outside of work that are important to me.
Yeah.
And right now, as you know, as we're taping this, we're still in, I know people are bored with it and they think it's over, but we're still in the midst of a pandemic.
Yeah.
And so I am fortunate to be able to not have to take shifts during the pandemic. And I made that decision for a lot of different reasons, but mostly because, you know, it's dangerous.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that can yeah. kind of kick off what we're going to talk about today because it's hazardous. We're essential. We have been deemed essential workers and we are essential workers.
Right.
But that doesn't mean it's safe. And in fact, I mean, I hear horror stories from veterinary workers across the country about things that their employers are asking them to do, the lack of protection during this pandemic. And that's not to mention all of the other things that veterinary workers are kind of subject to just in their normal work before COVID.
Sure.
And so in any case, that has given me a lot of freedom. And I, as I said, I'm very fortunate to be able to kind of pick and choose right now to say I'm not going to take any shifts.
Well, that's smart for you right now because it's not like you don't have enough stuff to do.
Yes, that's
so
true.
So let me get to my actual question before we totally get derailed. So thinking back on this wonderful year of 2020, what has 2020 looked like for you in the vet tech arena, and what is 2021 going to look like for you?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So, I mean, I kind of already preluded the question by saying, you know, so I worked in December, and then my husband and I had this trip of a lifetime planned in February, which luckily we were able to do our trip, and we went to South Africa. And so I didn't work in January because...
Oh my gosh, that seems like so long ago.
I know.
I remember seeing the pictures. Wow.
Yeah.
That was still this year.
It was still this year. So
no,
I didn't
that wasn't
work
this
in,
year, was it?
It was, yes. So I didn't work in January because we all know that veterinary hospitals are petri dishes. And I was like, I'm not going to get sick before I get on a 24-hour plane ride, basically, to the southern tip of Africa. So I didn't work in January. Then we left February 5th, I think it was, somewhere around there. And then I was in Africa. We got back at the end of February. And basically, you know, within a couple weeks of being back, California went into basically a lockdown. And in March, I think it was in mid to late March, the clinic where I was doing a lot of relief work, I was, you know, had like a regular relief gig there, and they said, oh, we're going to furlough you, you know, to clean up our payroll, help with our PPP loans, you know, all of that stuff was happening. And it was back at the time when no one really knew what was going to happen in the veterinary industry. We didn't know if it was all just going to drop off. There was going to be no business whatsoever. I mean, now we look back at that and say, oh, boy, what? That was wrong. Yeah. But we didn't know. Was it going to continue to be busy? Were we not going to need as many people? And so the clinic, it was easy to say, oh, we're going to get rid of the relief tech, right? Because we're probably not going to need her. And so that kind of kicked it off. And then just making that decision not to take any other shifts. So I haven't really been out there actively looking for other shifts, although I get contacted probably every week by people needing relief technicians. So for me personally, you know, I've been on the outside looking in. I mean, I still have my own pets, and of course they all have bizarre medical problems, as all of our own pets have.
Right.
So I've been that curbside client and dealing with, you know, all kinds of crazy things with our pets curbside. And because I'm also a veterinary technician, you know, I'm talking to people in the industry. I'm talking to the people who are taking care of my pets and how they're dealing with curbside and all of that that's around it. And it's been insane. I mean, Dave, I know you're not working in a clinic right now.
Right.
And Jeff, you've been in academia. So, I'm not sure what it's been looking like on the academic side. But, you know, just for your regular run-of-the-mill clinic or even emergency hospital or, you know, specialty service or whatever, it is, excuse my language, but it is balls to the wall busy. Mm-hmm, yeah. They are, my GP is booked a month out for appointments. You can't get in for an appointment with your pet for anything for a month. And specialists, it's the same. It is crazy. Yeah. So there's that part. Then when you add on top of that, people who don't want to or can't work because of the pandemic, right? Because they are immunocompromised, because they take care of someone who's immunocompromised, whatever that might be. So that's one reason.
Or if they just have kids and they have to homeschool their kids now.
Right, yeah. Right. You know, there are all kinds of reasons that people can't work. So now you have, so it's busy. Then you have low staff. Then you have people who are actually getting sick and going out sick. So not because they're not wanting to work or can't work, but they get sick, which in turn is affecting the rest of the people in the clinics wherever they're working, right? And so it's been a year. And it hasn't even been a year. It's been a crazy 7 months, really, is where we are.
It's only been 7 months?
Yeah. Because it's basically the middle of March.
Yeah.
When everything kind of hit in the U.S. And you're right. When you think about it, it's barely even half of a year. I mean, it's just over half of a year that we've been dealing with this. And it's crazy. And I don't think any veterinary professionals, any of your caffeinators listening, would argue with that statement.
Yeah. No.
And I will say, you know, that I have heard from people who work at these big corporates, since, you know, I'll kind of ease us into our conversation today, that these companies are making huge amounts of money. They're making more money this time this year than they were this time last year. So not only are they making more money, they're making more money overall. They're making more money per visit, which is something that I think people are noticing, that animals that are coming in, it's not just more animals. It's not just more regular visits, but it's sicker patients who are coming in, and I don't think anybody knows why that's happening.
Right.
And so there's a lot of money being spent on veterinary care right now. And that's great in some ways. Unfortunately, it's not really, we're not seeing that where I would argue we need to be seeing that kind of money.
Yeah. Yeah, that'll be interesting to see, because I'm sure somebody will do some statistic evaluation in terms of, you know, dollars, say, in gross dollars or whatever spent on the profession in 2018, 2019, 2020.
When we compare it to the you know, quote unquote Great Recession, what I find really interesting when we look at the numbers from whenever that was, but veterinary medicine was the one industry that did not have losses during the Great Recession. We didn't grow, but we stayed level. Yeah. And that was insane, because in the Great Recession, every other market in the, you know, in the economy, in the U.S. economy, every other area, every sector dropped except for veterinary medicine. And we're and now with this, whatever you want to call it, recession, downturn, I mean, bordering on depression, we're seeing, you know, we're still seeing huge amounts of money being spent in the veterinary industry.
Yeah. So before we get to the to talking about unionization and so on and so forth, I mean, obviously 2020 is a little bit of an anomaly just because of everything that's going on, like what you just talked about. Where do you see the veterinary technician profession right now?
Boy, that's a good question. It's, I mean, I feel like we're in crisis. I feel like our whole side of the industry is on fire right now, honestly. This pandemic has, in my mind, in my impression, and I know, as you said, the demographic studies are going to come out later, but I think it's accelerated that lifespan of a technician that we all read about, you know, that we all hear about, that credentialed technicians only last 5 to 7 years in the industry. And it feels like that has accelerated.
Yeah.
It feels like people are leaving at a much more rapid clip. And it feels like people are more and more burned out. And I think even more than burnout, a lot of people are suffering from compassion fatigue, but also just suffering from, I don't know if it's suffering, but like just being done with, with the way that they're treated by clients, by managers, by coworkers. And, you know, this is something I can't put at the feet of veterinarians. There are a lot of things I can put at the feet of veterinarians, but this isn't one of them. This isn't on vets for the most part. And that is kind of an interesting thing because it's one of those times when I think that the veterinarians and the support staff are feeling the same kinds of pressures and the same issues are affecting both sides of the profession, of the industry. I'm not sure how veterinary medicine comes out the other side of this. Schools, as Dave, as you know, because you're a teacher, you know, schools are suffering. I don't know what's happening with enrollment at your school, but I know that students are having trouble. I know that it's difficult to teach online. It's impossible
it's very,
to teach
it's very
many,
difficult.
Yeah, and it's impossible to teach many of our skills online.
Yeah.
So what kind of technicians are we going to be graduating? This is no ding on instructors, but it's a whole different world to, you know, how we're going to teach these technicians that are coming out. And I don't know what's happening on that side, if how what's happening with enrollment, if we're going to be getting more, but I do know that a lot of technicians and assistants are leaving. And I think that more and more are going to leave before we're out of the pandemic. So when we ask, you know, when we talk about what's the state of the veterinary technician right now, it's not great.
Yeah,
that's true. And what I'm afraid of is that it's going to push the industry more towards an assistant model, more toward, you know, away from credentialing. And it's really, it couldn't have come at a worse time in terms of where our profession was going, because I think we were moving towards a model of urging more credentialing, having, you know, making sure that clinics had credentialed technicians on staff. And I don't know where we come out when we come out of this pandemic, if they're even going to be, if we'll be there to do that. And that's a concern that I have. I hope that I'm being catastrophic. I hope I'm, as my husband says, I hope I'm catastrophizing this. And, you know,
I like that word.
I mean, it fits. It fits for 2020,
it does.
Certainly.
It really does.
And I hope that's where I am. I hope that I'm being a real Debbie Downer when it comes to this, but it's yeah, exactly. But being positioned where I am right now in my role with the union, it's hard for me to see where we come out on the other side.
Just as a follow-up to what you just said about, you know, the state of the profession and getting quicker into burnout and losing technicians and all this stuff, do you think that was a continuation of something that had already started, or do you think that it's isolated more towards what's going on with COVID, or do you think that COVID made it just that much worse?
Yeah, I think COVID was the catalyst.
Yeah.
I think it was going to be something. I think, I don't know if you guys had this, but I have been feeling for a while that there was something big coming to the veterinary industry, that something had to give, basically. We were in a spot that what we were doing, what we are doing, isn't sustainable. So how do we move through that? And I was really hopeful. I think that there were really strong movements towards, as I said, towards credentialing, right? Towards the AVMA Task Force on Technician Utilization came out with a big list of their recommendations for how we can retain technicians in this industry, credentialed technicians. And they had great recommendations. And I was hopeful that maybe there was going to be some movement in the direction that I really hoped the industry was going to go. And now I just don't know. I think all of that has been thrown into chaos a bit. We all know that any legislative efforts, for example, for anything that's not COVID related, it's not happening. So that's one side of it. And from an economic standpoint, I'm afraid that these big companies are going to realize that they can do more with less, and they'll try to continue to do that, which just means more burnout, more churn, right? That revolving door in the clinic is going to start spinning faster.
And from your position, you know, as somebody who has their hands in a lot of different projects, and that's putting it mildly, I guess. What do you see as the biggest obstacle in our profession, and what steps would you personally take to fix it? Like, I know you have a lot of big ideas, and a lot of you're pulling your information and your experience and knowledge from a lot of different places. What types of things can we do to fix what's going on right now?
As I already alluded to the AVMA Task Force on Technician Utilization, and they came up with a whole list of action items that they proposed to the AVMA, and so now there's a working group, basically, that's working on that, on the action items that were raised by that task force. And I think that a lot of the stuff that they talk about there, and I was one of the folks that they asked for input, which I was, you know, really glad I was able to provide that input. So a big part of keeping technicians in the profession is utilization and respect and pay. We have to make this a sustainable job. And it's a lot of us will take less pay, you know, because we love what we do. We love our coworkers. We love the animals. And if we're utilized, if we're getting to use all of our skills, if we're getting to use our knowledge, a lot of us will accept lower than we're worth in terms of pay. And historically, that has been the case, right?
Yeah.
But we can't continue to do the job that we're asked to do with the pay and the benefits that we're currently receiving. And I think right now, especially in the middle of a healthcare crisis, benefits are incredibly important. And, you know, we can talk about that when we talk a little bit more in detail about the union. But in terms of the veterinary technician profession, I think the biggest thing is teaching veterinary students, really getting them while they're in school, teaching them how to properly use every member of their team. And I really believe that veterinary schools should be, you know, teaching hospitals should be structured like any veterinary specialty clinic that's out there. So you should have, you know, a front of the house team, a front desk team. You need the doctors, you need credentialed technicians, you need assistants, you need kennel help, all of those people. And the veterinarians need to be taught how to use each group of those people appropriately and effectively. Because if you do that, if you start in vet school and you teach veterinarians that, when they come out, they're going to build teams that look like that. And that would lead to less burnout for veterinarians, more recognition, respect, and utilization for credentialed technicians. It would provide a really clear career path for that kennel technician, right? To see what does it look, because a veterinarian, right, who goes out and owns a clinic can then see exactly how that would work. Oh, first you work in the kennels and you clean up poop and pee and you fill food and water bowls and that's what you do. And then if you show an aptitude and an interest and a drive, you know, we can move you into an assistant position and here's what assistants do. And if you're then interested, we can talk about helping you go to school or finding a school for you to go to so that you can become a credentialed technician. And then you get to do this kind of job. And that is a ladder that's not clear right now, right? People, especially now, when we have this rotating door, we have people who like get hired as a front desk person and in 2 weeks are being trained, quote unquote, in the back as a technician because there just aren't bodies or no people. But also veterinarians don't know how to properly utilize their staff in different roles. So that's something I think that could go a really long way into starting to fix some of the problems that we're seeing. I was horrified to learn, and maybe some of the caffeinators will also be interested or horrified to learn, that veterinary teaching hospitals don't have a requirement to have credentialed technicians on their staff.
Hmm.
So there's no requirement. Some of them do, a lot of them do, but some don't. They just don't have any credentialed technicians working in their teaching hospitals or teaching any courses or anything like that. Nothing. No credentialed technicians. They use fourth-year students as free labor in the hospital, and they justify that by saying, oh, they might end up in, you know, these veterinary students might end up in a practice where they don't have a credentialed technician, which is why we have to teach them the skills that a credentialed technician should be doing. And that is a self-fulfilling prophecy. And they have, and we see that right now. They have fulfilled that prophecy in the veterinary industry right now. And if veterinary schools continue to do that, it will worsen what we're seeing now.
Yeah, to give me two big spoonfuls of that, because I have been tooting that horn for about the last 4 years. I just, at 100% dead on.
Well, and Jeff, working in academia, is there the types of things that she was talking about is teaching veterinary students to go through that. Is there time for that? Would that be a class that they would have to take to learn how to do that stuff? And is there time in their program for that?
Well, they build that time in. I mean, there's a week of when they're on radiology, there's a week of radiograph positioning.
Mm.
Why?
That's a week that could be better used with radiographic interpretation.
Right. Why? Why would they do that?
I have no idea.
It doesn't make any sense. When was the last time neither of you are working in a clinic right now, but I can tell you the last time I saw a veterinarian positioning a dog or cat for a radio.
And if they're doing that, it's a huge problem.
Because it's a huge waste of resources.
Right.
No one wants to pay the DVM's pay to be positioning for a radiograph.
No.
That just doesn't make any sense.
No.
And, you know, we look at this, you can point to this as an issue throughout the industry, right? When we look at student debt load for veterinarians and we look at their job satisfaction and their levels of burnout, if they could use their staff appropriately and if they had enough staff and they were able to be effective and efficient delegators, they would make more money.
Right.
And we know this is true because, I mean, we have data that's a decade old now that really needs to be, actually, it's almost 2 decades old now. It needs to be redone, that shows an increase to the net coming into the practice. It's almost $100,000 for every credentialed technician that's on staff. And if you use them appropriately, delegate to them appropriately, then you should be paying them appropriately because they are making you a ton of money.
Right. You know, just real quick on that too, Dave and I were talking before we came on air today about some ClinPath stuff and just how nobody does differentials anymore. Nobody does urine sediment anymore. People don't even do fecals anymore. And you know, he was kind of thinking out loud, but like, why do we even teach that in school? Because like everybody just sends it to the lab now. And it's like, he's absolutely right. It's a dying art and it's a dying skill that, you know, really used to provide a lot of value to a practice that has now basically been automated. But the utilization for sure.
Well, and I think, you know, send every fecal out. I don't care if I ever do another fecal.
Sure, yeah, we can do other things. As long as we're doing other things.
Right. But there are times when having a credentialed technician who can look at a slide, right? Mm-hmm. Who can make a blood smear, prepare a blood smear, do an initial evaluation, right? Before surgery. Hey, Mike, the machine says this animal has no platelets.
Right.
Is there someone here who can look and do a quick and dirty platelet count or a platelet estimate,
right?
Assistants can't do that. And I'm not going to use the word waste, but I want to use the word waste. A doctor's
misuse.
Time. yes, you're going to misuse a doctor's time in drawing the blood, making the blood smear, staining it, evaluating it. Why? Why are doctors doing any of that stuff?
Yeah, right.
They have four jobs and they should be doing those four jobs. And once veterinarians start to recognize that all they have to do is four jobs, they will be happier. Yeah. And they will make more money.
Yeah.
And then they can pay staff and staff will stay.
Right.
And everybody is happier.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and just to touch on the when we were talking about fecals, this was a good 20 years ago where I was in charge of the bill that went out to the lab. And I counted up one day and I said, the money that we're sending out the door to have a lab evaluate all our fecals. And again, this was 20 years ago. We could have spent $16 an hour to have somebody sit in the lab and do nothing but read fecals all day. And that was back when, you know, a high paying tech job was like $9.
Right.
And this was $16 an hour that we would have to pay somebody to just read fecals.
Yeah.
And we're sending that money out the door. Like, right. I never understood why we were doing that.
Right.
It's crazy.
Right.
Yeah. And I think, you know, and again, that this is, I'm happy to put the blame for that directly on the veterinary schools.
Yep.
Because I believe that's where it belongs.
I do too.
Because that's where they learn, right? That's where they learn how these things are supposed to work. And they're supposed to be learning the gold standard, right? They're supposed to be learning best practices. And they're not now.
Yeah.
Right.
So.
And if I've learned one thing the last few years, it's that change in academia is excruciatingly slow.
Yes.
Because what I didn't realize, like, you know, if there's something going on in a hospital, maybe there's a policy or a procedure that needs to change. Maybe there's a meeting, maybe there's a memo, and it's just done. Whereas in academia, ideally, whereas in academia, there's the clinical arm, but also the academic arm has to be considered and be involved. And
Right. And
so anytime a new idea is brought to the table, oftentimes by the time a solution is actually come up with, it doesn't do anything to actually represent what we came to the table for to begin with. So,
right.
Anyway,
no.
Anyway.
And you know, these are big organizations. It's what I'm talking about is big systemic change, but you know, 2020 is the year of big systemic change.
Yeah.
And
if only.
Yeah. Hopefully. I mean, I really think that would go a long way.
Yeah.
I think for right now, there are things that we can do to help move the profession in the direction we need to go.
Right.
I mean, and that's why you guys have me on today.
Yeah.
To talk about those.
Yeah. So let's caffeinators, get your coffee ready, get your probably not popcorn. What goes with coffee? Maybe coffee cake, biscotti or something. Cause this is the main event. So Liz, the National Veterinary Professionals Union. So we'll start with a couple of basics. What is it? Yes. How did it start? And what are its goals?
Yes. So we are an organization that started 3 years ago now. I think it was kind of officially 3 years ago, maybe a little bit longer. So Morgan Van Fleet was a technician, a licensed veterinary technician in Washington. She got fired by her corporate practice, and she got fired for an illegal reason, basically. And she thought, you know, I could sue them and I would win, but that would only help me. It wouldn't help any of my coworkers that are, you know, kind of left behind dealing with this. And so she had the idea of starting a union. And it started, I think it literally started as she kind of made a Facebook post, which was, we need a union. And I'm tired of this. And so I'm starting this union. And she made a website and like she posted on Facebook. And she says, I don't know if this is true, but she says that I was the first person to click the join button on the website.
I have zero doubts about that.
And in fact, like the join, it was like $10 dues or something. And so, you know, I paid it happily. And then she messaged me. She's like, oh God, no, don't pay. It's not a real thing. Like, I don't want to start taking people's money. How did you even find it? You know, kind of thing. And then we started talking and that's where it was born. It was born in a practice in Washington and a group of technicians who carpooled to work. In the Seattle area. And they started talking about it and how this is something our industry, our profession desperately needs, that it's hard to make change when you're owned by a corporation. And, you know, Jeff, that's why you said when you said, oh, you know, you work in a practice, you have a meeting and then things change, right? And that's true of most private practices, or you know, if it's owned by a couple doctors or whatever, it's super easy to make change because you can talk. The doctor's working with you right there next to you, right? They can all see that the lab machine is broken or the lead gloves are ripped or whatever, right? And so things happen really quickly. But with corporate practices, a lot depends on your local management, right? How effective they are, how responsive they are. Everything has to go through multiple layers before any change actually happens.
Oh, tell me about it.
And, right. Yeah. And so it's really difficult. And that was part of what, you know, these folks up in Washington were really dealing with was the loss of their voice in their everyday work, in their practice, the loss of, you know, I don't want to say power because we don't really have power, but that voice, the ability to have a say in what's happening in your work environment, it's a big loss. For those of us who are used to working in independently owned practices, and especially I think those of us who are working at a fairly high level in the practice, either we're VTSs or we're senior technicians or leads or whatever you want to call it, the loss of that voice is profound. And we all know when you look at the studies on burnout, the ideas of professional efficacy, of being felt like you're being heard, losing those things are huge contributors to burnout and compassion fatigue.
Yeah.
So about 3 years ago, feels like 3,000, it started there. And we got a group of people together who were interested in talking about how do we do this? None of us really knew how to be a labor union, what was required, how to start. We reached out to several bigger unions to try and partner with them, you know, to have them take us under their wing. The labor movement has been under siege for probably the last 30 years, maybe more. So it's difficult to be in the labor movement. And a lot of these unions have their own members that they have to deal with. And the idea of trying to start to organize an entire new industry is daunting. And so we didn't get a lot of hits on our requests for partnership. And then kind of out of the blue for me, we heard from this practice in San Francisco who had been working with the longshoremen, so the ILWU, the International Longshore Workers Union. And they got involved in our industry because one of the technicians at the practice in San Francisco, she's the granddaughter of an ILWU member. So she used to call her grandpa to complain about what was happening at work and asking him, is this legal? Can they do that? Is it what? This doesn't make sense, you know? And the grandpa is like, stop calling me. Here's the number for my organizer. call, you know, unionize. You're not happy with the way things are going. Get together with your coworkers collectively and fight and bargain for what you all want. And so they started working with the ILWU. Then they told the ILWU, oh, you know, we saw this thing on Facebook. There's this other union. Maybe you guys want to talk to them. And so that's how we got in partnership with the ILWU. And what that partnership gave us was a huge trove of knowledge of the labor movement. They have provided us with so much help and support and resources that we don't have, right? We have up until a month ago, we had $0, right? So all of us are volunteering.
What about your $10?
Yeah. No, Morgan sent that back to me.
She sent it back.
So, you know, we didn't have resources. We don't have a law firm. We don't have We didn't know how the organizing was supposed to work. We didn't know the ins and outs of what being a labor union was. So that was a huge help for us in terms of structure, support, and resources. And so now we're working in partnership with them and with a couple of other unions, and I'm not sure I want to be too public about
that. Yeah, you don't have to be.
But a couple of other unions also now, folks are starting to pay attention to our industry and the need for this in our industry. And more unions are paying attention because corporate ownership continues to increase in the veterinary industry. Right now, it's not big. It's a, I think it's about 20% or so corporate ownership. But there are some areas of the country where Mars owns every single veterinary practice.
It seems like it's greater than 20% in some areas.
I would bet in metropolitan areas it is, but maybe in more rural areas it's not.
Precisely. Because Mars owns Banfield, they own VCA, and they own Blue Pearl. And there are places, and I hear this from technicians all the time, they don't want to work for a Mars company, but they want to work in specialty or emergency, and their only choice where they live to work, if they want to work in specialty or emergency, is a Mars owned practice.
Interesting.
And I'm sure that will make Mars very happy, but it doesn't make those of us in the industry very happy. And it's not good for consumers because that's a monopoly.
Yeah.
And they already, when this merger went through, when Mars purchased VCA, they had to sell off a bunch of practices in certain metropolitan areas because the government was like, this is a monopoly. You can't do that. So they had to sell a bunch of practices, which they did. But now that the merger is done, they're on a buying spree across the entire country. They, in fact, VCA just bought my GP. So
wow.
So it's rapidly expanding. And so what happens then is there's a lack of choice for the consumer. They can't take their pet to a an independent veterinary practice in some cases, especially if their pet needs specialty care or emergency care. And then employees, they can't find another practice to work for. And what that does is it depresses wages and benefits in those areas because it's one entity that controls everything. So they can pick and choose. They can set any arbitrary number they want to pay.
Because
there's no competition. Right. Precisely right.
And I've heard of that, and this is something that's kind of been tinkering around in my mind for the last, I don't know, a couple of years, is that practices that I've worked at, they would say, when people say we're not making enough money, they'd come up with these statistics of the local wages for veterinary technicians, and like here's what people are making in this area. It's like, well, you guys are setting this market that you're just telling us what you're willing to pay. That's not, if nobody's increasing that, it's never going to change. And if there wasn't minimum wage laws, we'd probably be making less than we are now.
And the biggest issue there, you know, that they do that, you're right, Dave, they do this salary, you know, this compensation model where they look around to see, oh, what is everybody paying in this area? Instead of looking at their income and their income, their revenue per hospital, and then determining what's right on one side. And on the other side, what's an actual living wage?
Yeah.
And of course, that can be a huge debate in and of itself, right? There's no actual definition of a quote unquote living wage. You can't go to a government website and say, tell me, what does a living wage mean? It's very amorphous. Economists have talked about it for years. There are lots of different definitions. The way I define it, and I think it's a common sense definition, which is, can you live on your salary? And by live, I mean pay rent or a mortgage, if that, you know, in your area. Can you live by yourself and pay rent and then have enough money for food and to have a decent, quote unquote, standard of living? Like, can you buy new clothes when you need them? Can you occasionally go out for dinner or a movie or whatever? Can you afford internet service? All of these things that kind of go into a normal standard of life. That's what I consider a living wage. And I think everyone in the U.S. deserves that. And veterinary technicians, on the whole, for the most part, the vast majority of us do not receive a living wage. We are living at or below the poverty line. We cannot afford to live by ourselves. We cannot do this job as our only job. We have to have roommates. Almost all of us have side gigs to make that extra money so that we can have a normal, quote unquote, standard of living. And that's not right. And it's not right when we're talking about an industry that had no downturn during the Great Recession and that continues to make huge amounts of revenue every single month during this pandemic in particular. But before the pandemic, I don't want to be too prognostic, you know, I don't want to think too far ahead. but I can guess that that spending isn't going to slow down very much when the economy starts to ramp back up.
Right. I'm going to play a little bit naive here because I am a little bit naive about unions and things like that. What are some arguments in favor of unionizing veterinary professionals?
I think the biggest argument for me is giving your staff a voice with the people who are making the decisions. It's very easy for a large company to ignore one person or two people or label them as a complainer or a troublemaker or whatever it might be. But when you're all banded together, when you're standing in solidarity with each other, when you all have each other's backs, you're all going for the same goal for everybody in the hospital. They cannot ignore all of you together. I say that. Unfortunately, I kind of am playing my own devil's advocate here because a company like VCA, and this is part of the problem, that you know they're so big, a company like Mars, they can ignore an entire staff and you know shut down a hospital and not lose a lot. And that's dangerous, right? So you and in fact, this is what we see happening at that first practice in San Francisco. They are strangling the hospital. They aren't hiring new staff. They're closing services. And it's just this slow march towards what is starting to feel inevitable. I hope it's not the case. But this is the threat. This is the threat when a company is that big that, and when they're in a metropolitan area like San Francisco, right, that they could close one hospital and either redistribute the doctors or whatever. And I'm not saying that they're doing that, but I'm saying that's what it feels like they're doing. And when we're in bargaining with them and they're sitting across the table from us and they're telling the people across the table who are the employees of the practice, who are veterinary technicians, you know, VTSs and assistants and credentialed technicians, they're sitting across the table from folks who have been in this industry, working in this industry for 20 plus years, you know, each individual person, and then telling them, oh, we don't pay techs because they just leave, because this is a stepping stone job. It's not a career. To say that to someone who's put 20 years of their life into their profession, who has gone on and to get an advanced certification, who pays $350 a year to maintain, or every 2 years, excuse me, to maintain their license to practice, to then tell them it's not a career. It's a huge slap in the face.
Yeah.
So the argument for me is stand together with your coworkers. If you want to create positive change, if you don't like what's happening in your workplace, you guys can all get together and fight for the changes that you want to see in your workplace. It is not without risk. And it is a lot of work. And it is a scary proposition to jump into it, especially for us, because veterinary technicians, veterinary assistants, kennel staff, we are living paycheck to paycheck, if that. Right. A lot of us, especially now in the middle of a pandemic, are incredibly reliant on any, even the most meager of healthcare benefits. And it could be dangerous for us to lose those. Although, you know, it's not like every single veterinary hospital in the country isn't trying to hire other people. But that's not really the point, right?
Right.
So it's scary. It's a really scary thing to do, to put yourself out there to try and create this change. And it is a big hill to climb.
Is there risk of like backlash from employers? Like,
Yeah, retaliation is real. You know, for the most part, Mars is pretty smart about it. They have a really experienced law firm who is doing their and a ton of anti-union consultants who provide them with good counsel, which is, it's really not a fight you want to take on. Like, don't fire people just for organizing. Even in an at-will state, you better have a good reason to fire them that's separate from their organizing activities, or you're going to have a problem with the National Labor Relations Board. But that doesn't preclude them from doing it. So most people who start to get involved in organizing, or if they want to, the first thing I tell them to do is to get a copy of their personnel file and be sure they have everything documented. So if they have any write-ups, if they have, you know, any kind of disciplinary action that they've been subject to while they've been an employee, to just have that and to have a ready answer for that if, you know, if they were to be fired, if they wanted to go forward with a wrongful termination suit.
What would be some arguments against unionizing veterinary professionals?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing is there's this fear, right? So the fear of potentially losing your job. I know a lot of people are afraid of, especially if they live in a smaller metropolitan area or a smaller community, that they'll be blackballed by other veterinarians, you know, that the word will get around, oh, this was the person who was organizing, and veterinarians won't want to hire them. So that's a big part of it. The negatives that I hear are things like that, and then so that the fear side, and then also it's a lot of work, and it really is a grassroots ground level effort. So it's not like the Teamsters are going to show up with a giant inflatable rat and picket your hospital, right? And I think a lot of people want that. They're angry at the way they're being treated. They don't like what's happening. They're overworked. They're exhausted. They're at the ends of their rope. And they reach out to me. And I think they hope that we're going to swoop in and tell their bosses that they're awful, terrible people, and they need to treat their employees better, and here's the contract that you are now subject to, and we just can't do that. Doesn't work that way.
Right.
So it's, you know, and we are exhausted and we're underpaid, and none of us have the energy to take on a huge volunteer project, you know, like that, even if it's for the betterment of our practice. It's just it's a big ask, and that part is difficult. Then, you know, there are the usual anti-union things that you hear, the kind of tropes, right? Unions protect lazy workers. Oh, you have to pay union dues. They're going to take money away from you. You're going to end up making less than you make right now, which neither of those things holds water when you start to drill down into them. But that's what we hear a lot on the anti-union side. And then the company uses it as a stick and carrot approach. So they say, oh, you know, you won't get the raises that other hospitals get if you're part of a bargaining unit, because it'll all have to be negotiated with the union. But like, what, the union is them. It's the employees. Do you really think the employees are going to say if the company came and said, we'd like to give you guys the same raise we're giving this other hospital, do you really think the union is going to say no? It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
So I mean the anti-union side tries to really foment a lot of fear and uncertainty and a lot of doubt in the minds of people who are thinking about organizing. And to some extent they are successful. So we have been successful on our side, and we've run now 4 successful campaigns with really big margins of victory in 3 out of 4 of those. In one of them, the margin of victory was fairly small. In another, there was another campaign we ran in Berkeley. So that's the number 5. We have 4 practices right now that have voted to organize. One of those actually has a contract. They signed a contract in August, which is very exciting. That's the first union contract in private veterinary medicine, which is super exciting. And we had one other practice that we tried to organize, and they got to their union election, and it ended in a tie. And anytime a union election ends in a tie, that means that the status quo holds. So that means no union. And then we have to wait a year before we can go back and try again. And you guys know, and everyone listening knows, in a year, the staff could be completely different.
Right, yeah, exactly.
A whole different group of people, and especially now more than ever. So that, you know, that's the anti side. Other than that, I mean, I was raised in a super conservative household. I am definitely not that anymore. But for a long time, I thought, what's the point of unions? That was something we needed in like the 20s and 30s, you know, when you had kids in coal mines and we didn't have weekends, right? Like, what do we need unions for now? We've already settled all that. But when you start to look at the lack of input, the loss of our voice in what happens to us in our day-to-day work life, that's what the union is for, to really fight for your rights in the workplace and the rights of your coworkers, and to help make your practice better. And I believe in the best case scenario, a union negotiation is collaborative, because we're all on the side of wanting to improve the care for the patients And the way we do that is by taking care of the employees that take care of those patients. And if we can take care of them and keep people in the hospital for a longer period of time, maintain that training and experience on your staff, your patients will have better care. Your doctors will be happier. You'll have less turnover. You won't have to spend a lot of money on hiring new people. You won't have to worry about training new people because you're going to keep those people on board because now they have a voice in what happens in their workplace and they're going to want to stay.
You mentioned the campaigns, that was your term for it, and those contracts that were signed, or I guess it's just one contract
just
that's been signed.
One so far.
What's involved in that? Like what is in that contract? Is it defining what wages should be, healthcare, things like that? What's involved in it?
The way organizing works, generally speaking, is a group gets together. We call them the organizing committee. It's usually a group of around 10% of the total staff at the practice that might be a part of the union. Our union doesn't include veterinarians, and it doesn't include anyone with management responsibilities. So no one who can hire, fire, issue disciplinary actions, or make decisions about pay. So those people can't be a part of the union. So the organizing committee gets together. They work to talk to their coworkers to figure out if folks are interested in working together to create positive change in the workplace. And once they get a majority of those, they sign an actual physical piece of paper, a card that says, I want XYZ group to represent me as a collective bargaining group. So I want to be a member of this collective bargaining group, and I want this union, usually, to represent me. Then those cards are presented to management. So the organizing committee usually will go to management and say, hey, we have, 80% of the staff who wants to have a union, and here are the cards with their names. And then management has a choice. They can either say, okay, we'll accept this as representation, let's move to the bargaining table. Or, and in our experience, this has been in every case, they have said, okay, we see that you guys want to have a union. We don't believe these cards. We think they were coerced or whatever. So now we're going to have an election. So they have an actual union election. And then the results of that election are ratified by the National Labor Relations Board. And either the union is approved and the bargaining unit is recognized, and then you move to bargaining, or the union loses and it's status quo and there's no union at that hospital. If the union wins, you move forward to bargaining. So usually what happens is the group, the employees, select some representatives to go to the bargaining table. At our tables, we have support from the ILWU. We used to have a lawyer join us, but we don't have the lawyer there anymore because that saves us some money. And we found we don't really need the lawyer because we can advocate for ourselves very well. So that's what we're doing at our bargaining tables. And we have the help of our union rep, who's there to really help us make sure that everything is staying on the right track, because we're just not experienced on the union side, the labor organizing side. And so helping with that. And then it's really a clause by clause by clause negotiation. So right now, for example, at the National Veterinary Professionals Union, the NVPU, we have one bargaining unit in Seattle. And I am sitting at that table with our team there, which is great. That's one thing that COVID has done for us that is a positive, which is we do remote bargaining. So now I can be at every bargaining session. I don't have to travel to Seattle.
Oh, that's nice.
To sit in a conference room, I can just sign on to a conference call, and we do it that way, which is great. We haven't even gotten to the meat of wages yet. So there's a lot of other things that we're talking about. And one of the big things that the contract that they got, which was with a pet vet, so a non-Mars practice in Vancouver, Washington, one of the big things they got in their contract was a layoff procedure. And I think that's something super important in this COVID time. How are they going to decide which employees get laid off? What's the process going to be? And for me, when I heard about that, and I was like, why is that important? Why does that matter? And I realized it matters because of favoritism. And we all know that favoritism exists. We wish it didn't, and managers will claim it doesn't, but we know it does. Mm-hmm. And that can be really evident in a layoff time, right? Because an employee and a manager could just decide, I don't like that employee, or they're a troublemaker or whatever. So we need to lay off some people. That's going to be at the top of my list. But nothing to do with anything, nothing to do with performance or even pay in some cases, right? Just, I don't like them, I'm going to lay them off. So that is something that when we're in a pandemic like this, where layoffs are probably going to happen or did happen to a large extent at the beginning, maybe not so much now, that was a big deal. And, you know, you had people who were reliant, again, on their healthcare, on that paycheck. They're living paycheck to paycheck. So really having a process like that is important. The other thing this contract did in Vancouver at the pet vet practice, Columbia River Veterinary Specialists, it set out wages. So they have very clear wage structure. Everybody knows how much everybody's getting paid. If you are at a certain level or have a certain job title, this is your pay. And it's very clear how you can move to the next level. And that's a thing that's also not based on favoritism, because there are some structures in some of the Mars-owned hospitals where they have a quote-unquote level-up process, but whether or not you level up can depend on who you work with on a regular basis. Who is the person signing off on that leveling up? What is the criteria? In some cases, it's not clear. So it can be really difficult to get into those higher levels of pay if you want to. But this contract lays out exactly how that happens. Also, benefits and how benefits work and how changes to benefits happen. That's another thing that is covered in the contract. One of the things we just were negotiating at our last bargaining session was bereavement leave. I mean, things that you think about are like a normal workplace thing, right? But it's not covered. And it may have a mention in the employee manual, but maybe the employee manual just says, oh, you get bereavement leave if your kid dies or one of your parents die, but nobody else in your family, right? Or if your in-law died, like if your father-in-law dies, you don't get bereavement leave. You can't go to their funeral. Sorry. Too bad. Right? So it's those types of things that the bargaining committee is looking at and working through on a clause-by-clause basis, basically. And as I said, the best tables are collaborative. We all want what's best we want the hospital to succeed, because if the hospital succeeds, we all continue to have jobs. We're able to take care of the patients that we want to take care of. So we want the hospital to succeed. We don't want to put barriers to that success. But in order for the hospital to really thrive, they have to take care of their people too. And that's what we're fighting for.
Gotcha. You know, we've talked a lot about large corporations, Mars specifically. We even talked earlier about the demographic being like 20% corporate-owned practices in America. Where do still the like single doctor practices, the mom and pop, if you will, where, you know, one is the owner and one is the practice manager or whatever the model might be. Like, where do some of those clinics fit into this? Like, can they still be a part of that? Like, I mean, obviously they still have to go through their whole process like you were just kind of laying out, but, you know, because they don't have that big bad wolf or whatever, you know, that's at the top, like, can they still take part in this?
Yeah, they certainly can, but it's something I would argue that's not really all of that structure and the legal part of it and all that. It's not really necessary in a single doctor practice, or even if a practice is owned by a few doctors, you know, maybe it has 10 doctors on staff and two of them are owners or whatever it is. Because in most of those cases, those doctors are working side by side with you. You haven't lost your voice. Your voice is right there. But a lot of the same tactics that we use in union organizing, I encourage people in private practice, employees in private practice, to use. That is particularly the power of solidarity, right? If you can, you're not fighting just for yourself, you're fighting for everyone on the team. And if you can get everyone together, you know, on one or two key issues that are really bothering you, that you really want to see change happen, if you guys can all get together as a group and go to your management, your ownership as a group to talk about proposed solutions, that's powerful. And that is a powerful voice that you have right there with your owner who's you know, sitting in an office right down the hall from the treatment room. So it's not, we're definitely not working to unionize private practices, because gotcha. I think that we have that voice in those practices. Gotcha. Where we work.
Okay, cool.
Even if we frustrated, even if they tell us no.
Sure.
At least we know it's the one person, right, who has the power, who's right. telling us no. It's not like, oh, I asked my regional manager and they have to talk to, you know, corporate headquarters and blah, 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 and you never get an answer. It's right there.
Gotcha. Yeah, I will say I've worked in corporate practice and in private practice, and I will say that in private practice, you get answers like, if not that day, at least by the end of the week. With corporate, it could be months before you get an answer. Right.
And I think in my experience, in private practices, it's much easier to get that information too, right?
Oh, yeah. Like, oh, yeah, definitely. Like,
it's easier for an owner to say, I can't afford to give you raises.
Yeah.
And here's why. Right. And then what that does is it opens up an opportunity for a discussion because you've brought everybody in to the problem. Right. Oh, wow. Why are we spending so much money on catheters? Like, how did that happen? What's going on there? Or supplies or whatever. And it really then takes the whole team. It brings the whole team on board to solve the problem. Oh, we all want raises. We have to be better about the equipment we use. Right? We have to be more careful about, we can't just throw a cartridge away for, you know, our IDEX machine or whatever, because we can't make, you know, oh, we pulled the wrong one. Now we have to throw it away. Or, oh, you know, I accidentally opened this super expensive piece of equipment and now we're not going to use it. Right? Yeah. Like, it starts to make, it brings everybody into that owner mindset, basically, to start thinking about problem solving. Oh, where can we find more money that would enable you to give us raises at some point in time? Right. And I think that collaboration is awesome. And that's what leads to really great things in practice. And that's what you lose in a big corporate practice, because you don't have that collaboration. There's no transparency. There's no openness. There's no ability to work to collaboratively together to fix something without a collective bargaining unit, I would argue.
So in terms of the union itself and unionization, what do we have to do to make this gain more momentum and help this become more of a global thing? Global, but
no, a national, at least national thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. All of you that are out there listening, if you can hear my voice, contact
and I'm sure,
me.
I'm sure they can.
Contact me. I would love to help you figure out how to organize your practice. That's how we do it. It's a practice by practice effort. Once we truly believe that if we can get a critical mass of practices, if we can get 60%, 70%, 80% of maybe, probably wouldn't even take that many, of the VCAs or the Blue Pearls, right, to agree, to want to organize, to vote, that they want to unionize, that they want to bargain collectively, at some point, it's going to make more sense for Mars to create a national contract than it is to try and negotiate at every table individually. Hmm. And that's, if we can get there, if we have a national contract for an 800-pound gorilla like Mars, what that does is it creates an ecosystem in that organization for technicians. They all know what their wage is going to be, right? I don't want to get too in the weeds, but it's going to be, you know, dictated by region, right? All of that's going to be negotiated. This is my dream. You guys are hitting now my ultimate goal dream. And then when that happens, because these companies have large presences in these metropolitan areas, that will start to raise the standard for wages and benefits for other practices, because they won't be able to hire people unless they can get to some kind of parity with that company. Yeah. So right now, you know, they're using that power for evil to suppress wages and benefits, right? But I would argue the union can help them harness that power for good for the whole industry, because it's cliche, but it's true. A rising tide lifts all boats. And if we can get a preponderance of veterinary staff at a higher level of benefits, better pay in an area, if other practices want to be competitive in the hiring arena there, they're going to have to offer something similar or some other benefits that make sense for people who, you know, to attract that talent.
So, you know, one of the things you said in there a little bit ago was, especially when you're an office is kind of starting the organizing committee and what have you, and especially some of the corporations might try to almost stoke the fire of an us versus them type of situation. How, as maybe a clinic that is looking to organize, how do we steer away from us versus them?
Yeah, that's a big part of what, you know, of what we do on the organizing side. So we have a lot of information about, we know what they're going to say, right? So we can prepare the group, like, this is what you're going to hear. This is what the company is going to come in and say. And so we know that they've said that they're going to say this. And the reason we know they're going to say this is because they say this everywhere that people try to organize. And they wouldn't be fighting this so hard if they thought that a union would be to their benefit. They don't understand how it might benefit them, but in fact it does. And we need to stay focused on our goals, which are primarily improving patient care by increasing retention and reducing turnover. That increases patient care because all of us that are there are already trained. We have the knowledge. We're not going anywhere. We're staying at this hospital. We're supporting our doctors. That's what we want to do. We want to create positive change so that we can provide better care for our patients. And that's our main message, that we can't provide good care to our patients when we're underpaid and overworked. Something suffers. And unfortunately, it's either our mental health, our stability, or it's the care for our patients. And none of us want it to be the care for our patients. The hospital doesn't want that, and none of the staff wants that.
Wow. Liz, this is probably one of our longest episodes.
But I mean, I could talk about this all night.
Yeah, we could go all night with this.
And we will have to circle back and get a little bit deeper into this.
You'll be on for a third time at some point.
I'm happy to be. Anytime I can sit and have the dulcet tones of Jeff Backus in my ears, it's a good day.
Oh, Kat, aye, Kat, what have you done?
Oh, thank you so much, Kat, if you're listening. Thank you so much for this. So before we wrap up, is there anything else that you want to get across to the caffeinators before we get to your final question?
Yeah, thank you. Because I started by saying our industry's on fire. I don't know how we're going to come out of this on the other side. But this is the kind of thing that makes me hopeful. You know, seeing people standing in solidarity with their coworkers to create that change that they want to see, to work for the improvement of the profession, that's what keeps me going. So I want more people to do it. To continue to bring me hope for the profession and for the industry. So that's what I want to say. Let's keep fighting. Don't give up. Don't give up hope. There is hope.
Excellent. One quick follow-up, what you were just saying that made me think of, like, do you think this is something that could, especially, again, they're not a major corporation, but it is still a large organization. Do you think this is a model that could work in academia and vet schools?
Very interesting. I say very interesting because many vet schools are part of state employee organizations. So they already have union representation.
Okay.
If they're a state university.
Okay.
So it's a little bit different.
Sure.
And I think that some of the folks, the support folks working in academia, are kind of down on unions for that reason. And, you know, I get it because that union's not representing them. You know, that union is responsible for representing everybody in the unit. I don't know the logistics or mechanics of, like, bringing us in as another layer to work with their existing union. That's something I haven't explored yet, but so I don't know if that would work. Certainly at private schools, it's certainly.
That was going to be my next question, but okay. Gotcha. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, a school like that is a private school is no different from any other employer from that standpoint.
Interesting thought. Okay. Well, Dave, I know you got one more.
Oh, God.
Oh, you ready? Are we ready for the vet tech?
I think so.
I didn't get one.
Oh, that's right.
This was
one.
Yeah. Yes.
What did we ask you? What did we ask you? We asked you.
We
no, we did. We asked you if you were arrested, what would your friends assume was the problem?
That's right. It was a different question. Yeah. Before we did the would you rather.
Yeah. Now I feel like that answer would probably change.
You think?
Yeah.
Protesting to some degree.
Yeah. I think now if someone heard I got arrested, they might think I like punched a Nazi. or something like that. Which, you know, that'd be fine. I'm fine with that.
What was your answer? I don't remember.
I think you said speeding.
Yeah, maybe speeding. Maybe. Yeah, okay.
I'll have to go back and listen.
All righty. So, your Vet Tech Cafe, would you rather? Your very first.
Right.
First one.
Jeff, I don't know where you pulled this question from, but it's kind of cryptic, but we all know who we're talking about here.
Right. I wasn't going to say 2020 as a reference. I was going to say notwithstanding 2020 or the current administration.
Okay.
So I'm going to read it the way that the question is worded.
Yes.
Okay. And you take from it what you want.
Okay. Yes.
Would you rather have a 10-hour dinner with a headstrong politician from an opposing party? I wonder who that could be. Or attend a 10-hour concert for a music group that you detest.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
10 hours with either one of these.
You know, I gotta say, this is a really hard one. Oh, good question. I think that, am I allowed to fall asleep in the 10 hours?
At which one?
Well, either. But if I could fall asleep during the concert, I'd probably take the concert. But assuming that there's a restriction that I must stay awake, I would take the headstrong politician from the other party. And I think that comes from my upbringing of, you know, my parents, again, staunch conservatives, but their best friends were staunch Democrats, like way left Democrats. And I used to sit at dinner tables with them while they argued, and yet they were still best friends, remained best friends. And I think that is possible. So, and again, there's my hopeful side. See, you guys brought out my hopeful side at the end here.
All right.
So that would be my hope, that maybe we'd have a breakthrough. I mean, my ego tells me I would be able to change their mind and like fix everything. That's doubtful, but yes. I'll take the politician.
Well, yeah, because with a concert, you just have to sit there and take it.
Yeah.
It's all passive. You can't do anything about it.
Yeah, you just can't get away from it.
Yeah.
You can't.
I'm definitely, I don't think anyone would use the word passive to describe me. So
I'll take
the politician.
Anyone that uses passive to describe you doesn't know what the word passive means.
Right.
Fair. Yes.
Thank you so much, Liz. This has been awesome.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you guys for having me and for you know, having this topic on. I think it's an important topic, and I'm happy to talk to anyone who wants to learn more. They can reach out to me. They can send me a direct message on Facebook. They can email the union at communications@natvpu.org, and I'll send that to you guys so you can put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
They can follow our webpage and the union's Facebook page for more information too. And I'm happy to, you know, answer any questions that I can.
Fantastic.
Sorry.
It's all good. I was just going to say, that must mean it's time to go. All right, Liz. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Liz.
For chatting with us all about the union. And again, it's something that hopefully we'll be talking about again in the future. Just thank you so much for putting in some time, as always, in so many ways that you do for us, for the profession. And we hope to hear from you again soon. And with that, I will say thanks, everybody, for listening. Dave, Liz, I hope you guys have a great night, and I hope everybody had a great Vet Tech week.
And happy birthday, Jeff. Today's Jeff's birthday.
Thank you.
Happy birthday, Jeff.
Thank you. And thanks, everybody, for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe. Take care, everybody.
Bye, guys.
We would like to thank you for listening to the Vet Tech Cafe podcast today. We often talk about difficult issues facing our profession and chat with colleagues who have strong opinions of those issues. As such, we feel it is important to note that the opinions and views expressed by us as the hosts or our guests on the Vet Tech Cafe podcast are solely theirs and theirs alone, and do not represent any other person, business, institution, or any other entity. If you have questions relating to this, please email us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. Lastly, as Dave said during the intro, please like us, follow us, and take a minute to rate and review the Vet Tech Cafe podcast on whatever podcast platform you use. It really does help. Thanks again for stopping by the Vet Tech Cafe.